Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Sarah Tyson, Associate Professor of Philosophy in the University of Colorado, Denver. And I'm co-host of the channel along with Carrie Figdor, Robert DeLeese, and Alexis McLeod. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books, drawing from a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Beata Stoharska, Professor of Philosophy at the University of Oregon. Her book, Saussure's Linguistics, Structuralism and Phenomenology, The Course in General Linguistics After a Century, is just out from Palgrave Macmillan. In the book, Stoharska guides us to consider Ferdinand de Saussure's Course in General Linguistics anew. By delving into Saussure's autograph notes, letters, and student lecture notes, Stoharska reframes all of the hierarchical pairs promoted as part of Saussure's doctrine, the signifier and the signified, la langue and la parole, synchrony and diachrony. The book performs reading and writing without borders, that it also argues Saussure thought necessary to think about language. Along the way, it questions sedimented ideas about structuralism, post-structuralism, phenomenology, and the object of linguistics, which is to say language. Beata, welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Hi, Sarah. Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you today. Will you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background as a philosopher and how you came to write this book?
Sure. So I was always interested, just broadly speaking, in the humanities, in literature, in languages, in the arts. And I had a chance to study philosophy. Initially, I thought it would just be a 1 year abroad kind of thing. I went to Belgium to study philosophy at the University of Leuven or Louvain. And I was hooked very quickly. I became very passionate about the field. I thought that I finally discovered my vocation. I could have been an art historian, I could have been a linguist before, but I, once exposed to philosophy, I knew that it was it. I was educated, broadly speaking, especially in contemporary European philosophy with an emphasis on phenomenology, Husserl, Heidegger, Merleau-Ponty, Levinas, and Jean-Paul Sartre as well. Since I received my PhD, I have been deliberately expanding my horizons to include feminist philosophy, to include deconstruction as well. And I would say that my inclination is always to work at the borders of philosophy and non-philosophy. So for example, in my first book, which came out in 2009, Between You and I, Biological Phenomenology, I drew on contributions from developmental psychology, from sociolinguistics, as well as from the dialogical tradition in philosophy, especially Martin Buber, to develop this notion of what I call in the book I and you connectedness. So the idea that the self stands in relation to a real or possible or virtual or imagined addressee, to a you. And I drew in that book extensively on pronominal discourse, so these I and you pronouns, and I looked at how they function in ordinary discourse, in ordinary conversations, and how they establish the I as a speaker who is oriented toward a you. And then also I looked into how these I and you roles or position are both interdependent in ordinary discourse, but also how they alternate so that there isn't a fixed I or an ego, but the self is sort of shaped both by the speaker or the subject and the addressee modes. So there is no really a solitary ego at all based on this analysis, but we are always participants in a relation with an other. And so through this analysis, through this emphasis rather on pronominal discourse, I became very acutely aware of how language shapes our identity, how it shapes our relations as well, how this language form or this existential drama, grammar that situates us in the world. And so in the second book, which came out in 2015, Saussure's Philosophy of Language as Phenomenology, this one came out with Oxford University Press, I focused more expressly on this question of language and linguisticality. I should probably add that initially I set out to write a very different book. So I wanted to write a book that is situated, broadly speaking, within contemporary European philosophy of language. I wanted to write about Derrida and about Merleau-Ponty and Kristeva. And I wanted to kind of look at various ways in which they engage questions of language. And I started my readings by looking at the course in general linguistics, this foundational text that is taken up by various authors in contemporary European philosophy, like Derrida, like Kristeva, like Merleau-Ponty. And I was amazed to discover that this canonical text is very much removed from the source materials, from Saussure's own writings about language, as well as from the student lecture notes that this book is based on. And so I read critical works, critical editions of the course by Tullio De Mauro, an Italian linguist. I read this in French, and I read then Engler's critical edition of the course. It's a massive book in French. And then I was just so fascinated with, both with how far removed the course is from the sources, but also how this book, which is actually a posthumous reduction authored by two scholars who did not participate in Saussure's lectures in general linguistics and who kind of assumed this role of an intellectual disciple to Saussure and who were then able to author or ghostwrite the book in his name. I just thought it's a very interesting kind of story that we don't usually hear in philosophy or in the humanities more broadly. So I felt that we know very little about this great book and that we gain to learn something by really attending to how this book was made and how it became this great book in the contemporary canon of ideas. So I wanted to tell this story. And I am retelling this story. I'm telling this story in a more kind of concise and I hope more readable and engaging format in the book that came out most recently in 2020 with Palgrave Macmillan. So this book is deliberately written in a shorter and hopefully lighter and less jargony manner. I simply want to tell the readers like, hey, here's what I think you might be interested in knowing about the contemporary history of ideas, about how structuralism emerged, also about how phenomenology relates to structuralism, because all these questions have very much to do with that great book titled The Course in General Linguistics.
Yeah, I mean, it's a page turner, I felt like, as I was reading it, because I was like, how did this happen? I thought I knew what the course was about. And as I'm reading it from page one of your book, I had to let go of the legitimacy of what I thought I understood the course to be about. And I think you've given us a nice sketch of kind of the process by which that happened, that Saussure's notes, his students' notes were not the guiding light, that these two editors really had a vision for the book and then sort of promoted that vision. And you talk about them engaging in sort of a seance to produce the course. So, and it's partially because they were ghostwriting, but you also talk about the sort of inspired nature of their writing. So would you mind talking a little bit about how they produced this text, why seance is a good characterization, how you came to that?
Sure. So it's interesting to note that the two editors of the course in general linguistics, Charles Bailly and Albert Fécheré, they very deliberately positioned themselves in the role of a disciple to their great master, Ferdinand de Saussure. So they refer to him for notre grand maître, Ferdinand de Saussure, our great master, Ferdinand de Saussure. And they do so even though they, as I briefly mentioned, they did not actually attend the lectures in general linguistics that Saussure taught at the University of Geneva. They attended other lectures, but not specifically on the topic of general linguistics. And they very actively prevented the students who did attend these lectures from publishing their own lecture notes. And they used various strategies of intimidation and silencing to prevent the students from giving a testimony to Saussure's teaching. And they usurped this role of a direct disciple, of a rightful heir to Ferdinand de Saussure, in order to then be recognized as someone who has the right to say what Saussure's own linguistics really is about. So this master-disciple bond is really interesting because it both enabled them to kind of claim a certain degree of intellectual intimacy with Saussure himself, it enabled them to claim the right to intuit what his own ideas about general linguistics were, even though at that time Saussure was deceased, so they could not really consult with him, and he could not contradict them on their presentation of his ideas, but they could speak on his behalf. They could, as it were, infer from him or from his mind after the grave, after death, what he supposedly was himself thinking. So here's this notion of a seance, of engaging in a kind of a reading of what the wandering ghost himself wants to say, what he believes. So we can sort of imagine how the ghost would, as it were, be moving the hand and dictating what his own ideas actually were. I compare this method or this sort of this seance to divination in the book. The editors often note, for example, in the preface to the course, they say that they preferred to infer, or in the French, deviner, what Saussure's innermost ideas were. And deviner, the verb, comes from ultimately from the Latin divus, God. And so it indicates this quasi-supernatural insight into spiritual entities or into ideas that the editors would have had as, again, his disciples, as rightful heirs to his intellectual estate, as someone who could speak on behalf of the past master in this tone of presumed scientific objectivity and neutrality. So I think the seance is this kind of this method of using intuition, of divining what somebody really believes, what his innermost thoughts are, is interesting because it tells us a lot about how academic institutions operate, especially in the European context in the 20th century, but perhaps beyond as well. It indicates these, what I like to call, elementary kinship structures in the academy. So this notion of there being a lineage from the master to the disciple that mimics the patrilineal relation between the father and the son. And so property, material or intellectual, can be passed down along this line from the master to the disciple, like from father to son. The title, an academic title, can be passed down, for example, of being a chair in general linguistics at the University of Geneva. It can be passed down, this lineage, from the master to the disciple, as was indeed the case with with both Bailly and Sechehe, who assumed this academic title after Saussure's death. And so I'm very interested in these questions of who has the right to say what counts as being true about past masters, you know, who is considered to be a rightful heir or a rightful speaker who gets to speak on behalf of a past master. And I believe that these socio-academic lineages tell us a lot about the production of knowledge in academic institutions, and that perhaps the kind of the narrowness of the academic lineage, the emphasis on sameness, on passing down the doctrine in a sort of unaltered manner, it is tied to, I believe, to a certain sort of doctrinal quality of ideas. Both perhaps are overly narrow and exclusive. And so I think we stand to learn a lot about how the relations of power and dominance and prestige in the academy, how they drive the history of ideas, but also how they can promote a sort of exclusionary forms and narrow doctrinal understandings. And so I think that the kind of the morale of the story is that the academy benefits from diversity, because then ideas themselves are likely to be more complex and richer as well.
Yeah, and one of the things you make really clear in this particular case is that the motto many of us learned from the general course was something to the effect of, the only true object of study in linguistics is the language, considered in itself and for its own sake. And you really give this evidence that that's an editorial insertion, and that Saussure's understanding is, as you say, much more complex, much more nuanced, much less given to being doctrine, actually. And that part of what makes his view more complex is that it's perspectival. He thinks the perspective that you take on language shapes or constitutes the object that you're studying. And so language requires a perspectival orientation, a sort of like self-aware perspectival orientation to its study. And so will you draw out then the difference, right, between the doctrine that's this editorial insertion and what Saussure is actually, what he is actually discovering about language in his work?
Sure. So you just mentioned the concluding lines of the course, that language is an object that, paraphrasing, should be studied in itself and for its own sake. These are the famous concluding lines, sometimes referred to as the famous formula, that is oftentimes cited as a kind of quintessential Saussureanism. It's interesting to note that the line is apocryphal. There are no sources in the materials from the Nachlass that justify the insertion of these famous concluding lines to the course. These lines are important because, in fact, they are a response to a question raised early on in the book in the introduction as to what is the object of general linguistics. And so the entire book is framed around this opening question and then the concluding response to it. It's perhaps also interesting to know that the editors in this case, they inserted these concluding lines into the book. They also cited their own insertion in book reviews and in technical articles in general linguistics as if it was coming from Saussure himself, right? So they definitely went to great lengths to cement this formula as quintessential Husserlianism to really make it sound like it was a kind of a motto issuing from the great past master himself. I also want to add that that this famous formula is often cited in structuralist literature, so it has become a structuralist motto as well, and it's usually then cited in an admiring tone. The phenomenologist, for example, Paul Ricoeur, cites it as well, but now under the guise of this semiological challenge, as he calls it, that Husserlian linguistics raises to phenomenology. The famous formula has acquired a lot of weight for the development of both structuralism and phenomenology, and it kind of tends to indicate that there is a seamless transition from Husserlianism to structuralism in the way in which the course has been predominantly received within structuralism as a kind of a programmatic statement that enables us to both identify what the object of general linguistics is, which is the language, la langue, language as a structured system of relations, and then this notion of objectivity was taken up in other areas in the humanities, like psychoanalysis or cultural anthropology, with Lacan and with Levi-Strauss, and so they very much adopted this notion of objectivity in the humanities as captured by this famous formula that language is an object that can be studied on its own. Perhaps then the unconscious is an object that can be studied on its own with Lacan, or kinship structures are a form of an object that can be studied on its own with Claude Levi-Strauss. Now to get to your question about how this famous formula, this conclusion of the course relates to the sources, we definitely find a great emphasis on a point of view in the source materials. So Saussure emphasizes on several occasions that the object in linguistics is not a self-standing factum that exists in the world, but it emerges always in conjunction to the scientist's point of view. Right, so there's a correlation between subjective perspectival orientation and what is found at the end of that intention issuing from the subject. We also, interestingly enough, find a very extensive critique by Saussure of what he calls an involuntary assumption of substance. So he is critical of the tendency in linguistics until up to his time to kind of think about language as if it were a substance, as if it were kind of a pre-existent entity that does not really need a speaker or a scholar in order to exist. So he's very critical of this, of the substance metaphysical approach in linguistics, and he emphasizes that points of view are irreducible in linguistics. He does, as reflected in the course, identify two major perspectival orientations or points of view in linguistics. That's the famous synchronic and diachronic perspective onto language. So looking at language diachronically across time, how it evolves and changes in time, or focusing on a time slice or kind of a relatively stable arrangement of signs within a given era. The course reflects the importance of these two perspectives, synchrony and diachrony. And so, for example, if we're reading the introduction to the course, we will learn about the existence of these two basic points of view, the synchronous one and the diachronous one. But the way in which the introduction proceeds is to emphasize the importance of synchrony. Synchrony is privileged ultimately as a viewpoint or a perspective that gives us unmediated direct access to the object itself, la langue, the language construed as a system of relations between signs. So diachrony is kind of displaced as an external perspective, one that we could seemingly dispense with once we attain this head-on access to language itself. Whereas in the sources, there's a lot of emphasis on the duality of viewpoints and how these viewpoints are both partial and interlinked. So we cannot really opt for one and the exclusion of the other, but we're kind of moving and shifting our orientation to that very complex linguistic field. And we cannot really opt for one at the exclusion of the other, because this would iron out this duality that Saussure considers to be essential to both language and to language study.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, it's so clear from your reading of the Nachlass and the way that Saussure sort of reveled in the complexity, or he really respected that complexity and seemed to be willing to really stay with it. And part of what unfortunately happens in the editorial hands that the course came into is that there are these points at which they just try to make things simple for the sake of science or something like this, right? To make the object approachable. But it seems like Saussure himself was rather taken with this complexity, was rather motivated by it, and really found it, he seems to have gone towards it in his writings.
Yes, I definitely think it's fair. So that's, I think, the kind of the beauty, but also the drama and the tragedy of Saussure's work and of his life, is that he was consumed with this question of what language is and what is the best way of approaching it. He was very disillusioned with the state of the sciences at his time, and he thought that sciences needed to undergo a radical reform. At the same time, he had a hard time writing a book on general linguistics himself. And I think in part because he was disillusioned with the sort of normative expectations as to what a recognizable academic discipline should look like. And I think he was perhaps disillusioned with the academic format of a treatise that needs to be organized, using this architecture of parts and chapters. He wrote incessantly. So I talk about the many notebooks that he filled with notes, and they have to do with all aspects of language. But he resisted publishing kind of a recognizable academic treatise himself. So I think that he is consumed with this question of, how do we begin philosophy or science, which I compared to the questions that Hegel raises in his work as well, right? About like, what is the right way of beginning a science that is supposed to give us a kind of a a complete overview of this very complex heterogeneous field called language. So I believe that Saussure is extremely self-reflective in that process, that he is very acutely aware of the methodological, you know, issues, concerns raised when we approach an object, so-called, that is as complex and heterogeneous as language itself, right? Because language exists in the present moment, but also in the past. It's written, it is also spoken. We can attend to the signifying dimension of it, you know, the acoustic dimension, the graphic dimension, or we can attend to the idea, the signified content that is conveyed by it. We can talk about the social world, the speech community where language emerges, or we can talk about the documents, this oral or written that this community produces, right? So wherever we look, we're going to encounter these dual notions and how can we be scientific about that, right? How can we be scientific considering also the fact that the scholar is a speaking subject as well, and so is entangled and immersed in the very, you know, notion or object, so-called, that is to be examined, right? So I think that Saussure is a very complex, self-reflective, philosophical thinking whose sort of style of approaching the question of language oftentimes resembles the phenomenological orientation that pays attention to these questions of subjectivity, of consciousness, of our kind of irreducible entanglement or involvement in the very subject matter that we seek to examine.
Yeah, and that's, so part of what I wanted to ask about was Derrida's reading of Saussure, which is so influential. In fact, I told a friend who's a philosopher that I was interviewing you about your book on Saussure, and he was like, I think everything I know about Saussure is through Derrida, right? Like, he's really influential on this thinker. And you really argue that Saussure and Derrida are much closer than Derrida would have us see, given his reading. And so will you talk a little bit about how they're closer and also how Derrida would have missed that, right? Like how Derrida comes to his view.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So I spend a lot of time with Derrida's reading of Saussure because, as you mentioned, it is so highly influential. And perhaps the most influential reading is found in Of Grammatology, where Derrida is performing this very subtle, interesting reading of the course in general linguistics, and where he argues that the text unravels itself. It is internally divided between, on the one hand, offering this very classical narrative that echoes with the entire Western metaphysical tradition, whereby presence is privileged, and so speech would be privileged by Saussure because it purportedly offers us direct access to, you know, the plenum of meaning, to what exactly the speaker wants to say. But then on the other hand, the same Saussure is also, for example, using analogies from writing to talk about what language itself is. And he tells us that, language is nothing but a system of differences. And so writing, even though initially it seems to be kind of demonized by Saussure as an external cloak that disguises what language itself is, in fact, shapes the way in which he defines and analyzes and interprets writing itself, right? So I'm interested in how, you know, the way in which Derrida makes this case is shaped by the contents of the course, and especially by what is of editorial making in the course, right? So many citations we find in Of Grammatology from the course are in fact of editorial making. And just to give you an example, Derrida cites Saussure as saying that writing is a kind of deceitful disguise of language itself, right? So writing is in the French, in the past, vêtement, un travestissement. So there's this notion of a kind of a transvestite disguise that writing puts on, whereby it would, conceal what language itself actually is. And another example that I really like is, Derrida talks about the purported monstrosity and unnaturalness of writing for Saussure. And so he says that that a man proposing a fixed language would be like a hen hatching a duck's egg, right? So here the idea is that writing, any writing system, as well as an artificial language like Esperanto, kind of performs a very unnatural kinship relation of adoptive parenthood, and supposedly the reader is to be shocked by this unnatural kind of kinship scenario, and to look at writing with absolute sense of horror. Now, when you look at the sources, you'll see that Saussure does use this analogy, but in fact, it functions quite differently. So he says that language itself is a bit like a duck that has been hatched by a chicken. And that is necessarily so. So that means that language itself necessarily, whether it's speaking or writing or even thinking, is necessarily subject to multiple adoptions in various unforeseeable milieus. So we don't know exactly where it's going to be hatched, and we don't know exactly where it's going to be, adopted and taken up and taken into new directions as well, right?
It's the point of appreciation, right, for Saussure? Like, he loves this.
Well, exactly, he loves this. I mean, I think that's exactly what to him is fascinating about language, right? It's this unpredictability of it. It's the fact that it is subject always to foreign forces, that it is not controlled by, say, the author of Esperanto, right? To be a living language, it needs to be taken up in all kinds of contexts, and its fate is unknown. It cannot be scripted in advance. So Saussure loves it. He is not, this doctrinal, dogmatic thinker who wants to homogenize language into this portable little box where an object it can be contained. He revels, like you said, in this mystery of language itself. And so all this raises the question, like, why didn't Derrida look at the Nachlass? Why is he so attached to this volume of the Course in General Linguistics? Why is he deconstructing this book and not attending to this textual universe where perhaps deconstruction is already underway within Saussure's own writings? That's a question, that's a challenge that I raise to Derrida, right? For being so firmly attached to the book, for being a citizen of the civilization of the book in the way that he performs his reading of Saussure, and for not entering into this unbounded textuality Saussure is unpublished and less book-like writing offers. But having said all that, I'm not, my goal isn't simply to correct Derrida and to kind of expose him to have missed what Saussure himself had to say. My bigger goal in all this is to actually say that that Derrida and Saussure are much closer than we like to think, and or that they that their understanding of cultural signification is much closely aligned than just reading Derrida and Saussure may suggest. And so I developed two ideas in that regard, and I sort of label them by borrowing two terms from Derrida himself, and they are entrainment and contamination. So I argue that for both Saussure and Derrida, entrainment and contamination are in fact primary. So So entrainment has very much to do with the ways in which any, say, individual sign is entrained or shaped, even wrought internally by its relations to everything else in the system, right? So if we're thinking about the way in which the course presents cultural signification or linguistic signification, it opens in chapter one with a focus on the linguistic sign. And we read that the linguistic sign is characterized by arbitrariness because there is no natural relation of resemblance or mimicry between the signifier, the signifying content, and the signified idea, right? The example there is of the Latin arbor, a tree that supposedly labels a kind of a universal idea of this natural category, a tree. And this labeling can occur differently depending on what world language you're looking at, right? But when, when tracking the development of Saussure's thinking about arbitrariness and signification in the lecture notes, we see that this initial focus on the sign is just the first step in a much longer analysis that actually is going to revise the initially made claim, right? So we find out that this focus, this myopic focus on the sign itself, needs to be displaced by a more global perspective on language as a whole and on relations between signs within the system. So in the beginning was not the word, in the beginning was a web of relations connecting words. And so Saussure actually dictates to his students that, the projected chapter discussed at this point in the lectures, it should be renamed as from the sign, linguistic sign, to language as a system of signs, right? And this change does not transpire in the published course. And so we begin still with a fairly kind of classical preoccupation with an individual word, and then are kind of expanding it to look at the web of relations. For Saussure, the web is primary. Coming back to Derrida, he has this very inspired reading of Saussure in the book Gla, where he kind of following the title, he looks at the ways in which Saussure discusses onomatopoeic expressions in still chapter one from the course. So expressions that supposedly imitate their sound origin in nature, right? Gla or nel is supposed to imitate the sound made by a bell, and it would therefore mimic its original source is found in nature. It would stand otherwise, differently put, in a kind of a one-to-one relation, right? The signifier would stand in a one-to-one relation to whatever its originating content was. And then Saussure, Derrida rather says, well, isn't it the case that, the ear is struck not just by the natural sound itself, but rather by what the word, the signifier, actually signifies? And isn't it only because of that we can recognize the word as meaning, the sound made by a bell rather than something else, right? So there are no onomatopoeias, there are no signs or words directly imitating their sound source. Words or signs are always, again, entrained within the web or system of relations. And then again, looking at the sources from the Nachlass is useful because we see that everything that we read about onomatopoeias in chapter one is actually of editorial making. So these notions that there might be onomatopoeic expressions that directly imitate their sound source is of editorial making. Saussure in the sources himself emphasizes that there are no natural made or sourced expressions every sign is always already shaped by relations to the system itself, right? So entrainment is primary for Saussure as much as for Derrida. It is the systemic dimension or the relational dimension of language as a whole that makes individual signs or words signify, right? That's why we can hear the sound of a bell, right? Or we can suggest sound of a bell by talking about the knell or the gla, right? But they do not, you know, they do not need to resemble. They don't actually resemble their sound source. They do not signify by virtue of something like a suggestive sonority, but rather by virtue of signification. So always on the question of entrainment, and then a related question has to do with contamination. So just to put it very sort of bluntly, for Derrida, contamination indicates the various ways in which what is violently excluded from a given system infiltrates it, contaminates it, pervades it, right? So it kind of haunts the very scene, the very presumed interiority from which it was supposed to be expulsed. And we can think about this in terms of how the language system in general linguistics is supposed to expulse everything that is external to it, is society, history, subjectivity, you know, contingency, and so on, are all to be considered as extra linguistic factors that do not inhere in the interiority of the system itself, right? This is the structuralist understanding of language, where language is this relatively closed and autonomous system, distinguished from the social world, distinguished from history, and so on. Now, it's fascinating when we are reading Saussure's own reflections on language, and for example, on the interrelation between the language system and the social world, he is telling us that language is necessarily situated within the social world. So to talk about language solely as an entrained web of semiological relations would still be to traffic in what he calls an irreality, in a very abstracted and reductive and partial notion. So instead, we should actually consider language always within its situated context. And so, for example, he gives this analogy of a ship at sea that is a little bit like in this hen and duck analogy. A ship at sea is always driven by forces that are not completely subject to its control, right? A ship at sea, right, may be subject to, you know, pirate attacks or to, you know, the currents in the sea, to a storm. A mutiny can break out on a ship and wreak havoc. So there are all these phenomena, all these events that can disrupt the ship. Can you know, or can take it on a new course, an unpredictable course, but they are intrinsic and essential to what language itself is, or to what a ship in its context, in its maritime environment actually is, right? So Saussure is very critical of you know, what he calls an engineer's viewpoint, whereby an engineer, you know, situated on dry land would simply kind of examine the internal structure of the ship, how it's built, what are the different elements, how do they interrelate, and so on, right? A kind of a structuralist understanding of language that is relatively static and disengaged. He says this view is very partial and is likely to engender untenable abstractions. We actually always have to look at the ship in its situated context. We have to look at how it will move. You know, when it is at sea, when it is in its sort of, you know, proper habitat, right? So in the same way, you know, we can say, to kind of come back to Derrida, is that, you know, the ship is contaminated, right, by everything that might, you know, might happen to it. And we cannot predict what will happen to it and when, right? It is subject to these forces that seem to be external, but in fact, enable it, you know, carry it along its course and can take it off course as well, right? Both kind of directions need to be taken into account. You know, there's this unpredictability, contingency, and so on that needs to be, included in a rich, robust understanding of what language itself is. Right. So in sum, I think that Derrida and Saussure agree that this kind of static or purely synchronous understanding of language is too abstracted, is too reductive. And that we need to think about how the inner and the outer always intersect, interrelate, and so on. And so ultimately, I would basically invite us, readers of Saussure and of Derrida, in 2020 to read the writings by Saussure himself, the course, but also more broadly, the writings in general linguistics, see what Saussure had to say about language and language study, because I think then we will stop thinking about Saussure as this dogmatist and as an easy object of a deconstructive reading, and actually see him as someone who may be performing a deconstruction in the way in which he is emphasizing these dualities, these relationalities between the inner and the outer, between say in this case language and the social world as well.
And this, I think, leads me to a question I had throughout the book, because you do mention that Saussure filled over, was it 200 notebooks with his, mm-hmm. and you give a really, I think, compelling reading of this, which you call him a citizen of the civilization of writing, and you argue at another point his intellectual biography is a testimony to the end of the book, and you mean this in a very laudatory way, like you mean that mm-hmm. in a good way,
yeah.
And you actually credit Merleau-Ponty with being one of his better readers, whereas Merleau-Ponty has often been critiqued for not really understanding Saussure. And so this all leads me actually to kind of a weird question, I guess, which is were you tempted to just fill some notebooks on all of this? I can imagine it being sort of, I can imagine being entrained by Saussure's own reticence to publish, and the way that he was encountering these discoveries as something he could teach but not necessarily publish. Like, how did you get past that? How did you not just fill notebooks?
No, I love this question because I think it identifies the paradox of writing, of both writing a book about Saussure, his linguistics, and wanting to be faithful to that, and wanting to reflect this this endless writing process he engages in, his reticence to publish a book, and still me publishing a book detailing all that. And then a related paradox is, why should we continue reading the book, the great book titled The Course in General Linguistics, if it is so flawed, if it really misrepresents Saussure's own understanding of general linguistics as we can reconstruct it from his writings. So I think there is a paradox there. And my way of addressing the paradox is to say that perhaps we are all still as academics, as scholars, partially at least citizens in the civilization of the book. We are, so beholden to past masters and the canon of great books, right? And so I think that these books have a hold on our thinking and what we consider to be of import in the history of ideas, including the contemporary history. So the question that I often have is not only why did I write a book, but also why is this book, The Course in General Linguistics, so successful, right? And so established, and furthermore, is it not the case that the presence of this book on the market of ideas continues to draw attention to Saussure and to general linguistics, right? So let's imagine a world when this book was not ghostwritten and published in his name. Would we be having this conversation today? Would there be, right? Would there be a lot of, you know, interest in Saussurean linguistics, or would he have, you know, been forgotten, right? Would he have kind of fallen into this provincial obscurity of Geneva and perhaps be recognized only by some expert in historical linguistics, but not by, you know, students and scholars, both in philosophy and in the humanities, right? So, you know, so I guess I would want to emphasize the paradoxical nature of both writing books and of writing books about great books. You know, there is something problematic about that, right? I mean, we are performing and, you know, and kind of re-entrenching the civilization of the book in doing so. But I guess I want us, you know, if and when we continue reading books like The Course, I want us to at least engage in a critical reading that is mindful of both how this book was made and at what cost, what got excluded in the process, right? So I'm hoping that we can read both the book and the Nahlas. You know, some linguists, some scholars in Saussurean linguistics say that basically, you know, we should abandon The Course once and for all. It's such a flawed text that it doesn't really merit, you know, the name of you know, representing Saussurean linguistics. Let's only read from the historically authentic sources and kind of leave it at that. So, you know, that's one possibility, right? Is to abandon this book and perhaps no longer write books either. You know, I think in the context of contemporary history of ideas, we will probably continue teaching great books, right? And then the question becomes more like, how do we do it, right?
Do we do it
in a way that is mindful of this very fraught and complex history, right? Do we want to tell our students, hey, here's how the sausage was made, right? Here's who, you know, who did not get to tell their story about, you know, general linguistics, for example, right? Here is, you know, who got silenced, who got excluded from the inner circle of knowledge production. You know, here's who did not get to sit at the séance table and, you know, and intuit what the past master himself thought, you know? So I would love for us to continue reading The Course today, but to do it in a way that is informed by social critique, that is informed by perhaps a greater acknowledgement of how these you know, relations of power, inclusion and exclusion in the academy, how they drive the history of ideas, how they shape what we consider to be official truth, and how they sideline, you know, smaller truths in the process as well, right? And kind of have us raise the question, like, what do we do with that? You know, how do we perform knowledge with a deeper understanding of these processes of exclusion? You know, how do we perform academy better? How do we diversify it? You know, how do we make sure that it's not only great books, but also say letters, you know, correspondence by related actors that is included on our reading list, you know. So yeah, there is a paradox there, but I think that there are various kind of ways of you know, of addressing it, and I'd like us to address it in a way that is socially responsible, that is kind of mindful, that we create a certain culture in the academy, and that the culture that we create is likely to generate greater pluralism, or perhaps be continue to be as exclusive as historically academy tended to be. So yeah, that's how I think about that.
Yeah,
Yeah, that's great. And the book is a great guide to the project that you propose we engage in. So where are you going next? What's your next project?
So I'm currently working on a slightly different project, perhaps still related, but now branching out into social political philosophy. I have a project dealing with the moral ambiguity of violence. And so I'm trying to kind of rethink what violence is. I'm trying to think about the kind of duality still endemic to violence, and to think about it not only in this condemnatory manner as a destructive and harmful force, but also to think about it in terms of life affirmation and expression of vital energies, kind of in agreement with the etymology of the term from Latin vis, everything having to do with life and energy and force. So a force that can be destructive, but can also be life affirming. And so I have a chapter that's coming out in September of this year, 2020, discussing the views on this question of legitimacy, moral and metaphysical of violence in the works of Simone de Beauvoir and Frantz Fanon. This is my first step in what I hope will ultimately become perhaps yet another book that I'm going to write.
Oh, well, I'm looking forward to the article and to the possible book project. Thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you for having me. I really do appreciate it.